Have you ever wondered what happened to the legendary Chuck Norris? We recently saw a video he made and it was shocking. He's in his 80s and still kicking butt, working out, staying active, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife tried too, and she says she feels 10 years younger. Her body looks leaner and she has energy all day. With the stress of everyday life, on top of the toll all the world's terrible news takes on us, it's more important than ever to stay healthy. My Morning Kick is the way to do it. Chuck made a video that explains everything. Make sure you watch it by going to mymorningkick.com/useful. It'll change the way you think about your health. Once again, that's mymorningkick.com/useful. You won't believe how simple it is. Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
And I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Useful Idiots podcast is our website where you can support the show and get bonus content. And Katie, you know, we're well known for being a irreverent show about politics, but we also bring people their one-stop shop for all their cultural needs.
Exactly.
And you've just seen something that you think is of interest to our audience.
I did indeed. So on Sunday, I went to La Mama, which is a great venue, usually. And I saw something called Chernobyldorf. Yeah, Chernobyldorf, it's called.
It really rolls off the tongue.
It really rolls off the tongue. Chernobyldorf. Yes. An archaeological opera in 7 novels. And I found it a bit insufferable. The synopsis is, after surviving a series of disasters, the remaining descendants of humanity find themselves in a post-societal world following the death of capitalism, opera, and philosophy, wandering amongst the ruins of nuclear power plants, abandoned churches, theaters, and galleries. They try to recreate lost civilization through archaeological performance rituals, universal symbols, and signs, which are ultimately misinterpreted and gradually dissolve into the white noise of nature. What was interesting is that at the beginning, someone from the production introduced it and mentioned that they live next to a country of 100 million people who want to exterminate them. And then at the end, they held an American flag and a Ukrainian flag. And I missed this, but the friend who I went with told me that they also held up a black and red Banderite flag.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That Nazi collaborator Bandera and father of the ultra-nationalist Ukrainian movement that the U.S. is very much behind today. Yeah. That's really fitting. You know, that's going to be a hit with a liberal New York theater crowd because, you know, neo-Nazis in Ukraine are our current allies. You know, I had a somewhat similar experience going to like a liberal, I mean, tangentially related. I went to the debut performance of a Broadway show that came, it was like last year, I think. And it was based on the story of Reality Winner. Reality Winner was the NSA contractor who leaked what she thought was some really explosive information about so-called Russian interference. I've gone over this before. The evidence that she had actually showed the opposite of what I think she and many other people who believed in Russiagate thought it said. But regardless, this Broadway show was like about basically like the theme of it was basically this brave whistleblower had exposed Russian interference, and yet she was persecuted by our government for it because she was in prison for leaking. And the show is basically, it's entirely based on transcripts of her initial interrogation by the FBI. That's it. It's just like they took the transcript and made a play out of it. And, you know, it wasn't like horrible, but like underneath this whole thing was like, you know, wow, like finally the truth about Russian interference is being told. And it just was sad because, you know, Reality Winner went through a lot and had a terrible experience, but she was made into this martyr over a fake thing, which is Russian interference. And so I was in a crowd full of like really excited theater goers who you know, didn't feel the same as me. And it was pretty awkward.
I'm glad they didn't know you were there, because those theater goers would probably have attacked you.
I could have gotten beat up. It could have been mob violence. The first ever mob violence at a Broadway show.
Yeah.
You know, beaten with canes and handbags and all
binoculars.
Yes. Binoculars, yeah.
Although I guess it's more for opera and ballet. But programs. You could have been swatted with
programs. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I really dodged a bullet.
Yeah, you did. Yeah. We have a great show for you today. We have two guests. We have Maoz Inon, an Israeli peace activist whose parents were killed on October 7th, tragically. And we have journalist Asa Winstanley, who is talking about some very important reporting about what Israel did on October 7th. And it's very underreported. And he also talks about being smeared by the Washington Post for his important reporting.
It's a useful idea. It's double header.
And
it's a great one.
Good. Yeah. So should we do the four basic food groups?
Let's do it. What do we have for Democrat Suck?
Oy vey. Okay. So for Democrat Suck, AOC recently was on a podcast called I've Had It, which is hosted by Jennifer Welch and Angie Pumps Sullivan. The podcast describes itself as a, quote, comedic feel-good podcast, which will expose you to all things you didn't know you've had it with. Mm. And Ocasio-Cortez joined the program to play a, quote, hilarious lightning round of had it or hit it. So let's take a look at this.
Had it or hit it, Joe Biden.
Hit it. You know, honestly, here's the thing. I think sometimes people want electoral politics to be, we overly identify with, it's like, if you vote for someone, they have to be the embodiment of you. And that's actually something that I think Donald Trump provided to a lot of people, where it's like, if you voted for him and if you were a Donald Trump person, like you want, like it symbolized so much. But I think what we have here in this situation is a more just honest thing. There are plenty of things that the president does that I completely disagree with. I think, you know, right now what's happening in Gaza, I can't go on every single day seeing this. I don't associate myself with what's happening. But at the end of the day, we have to acknowledge that we just can't allow this fascist movement to grow in this country. You know, it's people are going to get mad on the internet because that's what they do. But I think we just got to be adults about the situation.
So, I mean, I understand that AOC wants to vote for Biden instead of Trump and wants people to vote for Biden instead of Trump. But I don't know if you have to say you'd hit it. I mean, it seems like a false binary, false dichotomy. Also, she's sexualizing the president.
Well, all I know is, so the show is called I've Had It.
Right.
So I wonder, I mean, how much you want to bet that both these hosts, like, to, you know, let's say they're annoyed with each other sometimes. How much, I wonder how many times they've both thought about quitting and like which one is gonna be the first to say, I've had it.
Right.
You know, that'd be a great way to leave a show called I've Had
True.
It.
But yeah.
But look,
I've had it with I've had it. Cause I don't like to hit it or had it. Yeah.
But what, you know, what AOC says, look, personally, you know, how you vote is a personal decision. What I don't like is like the disparaging of people on the internet. Like, is she not a person on the internet as well? Like, whenever you want to sort of denigrate someone's position, you just refer to them as, oh, they're just on the internet. They're just terminally online, as opposed to like who? Like, you know, AOC is an online influencer. I think actually that's one of her most significant, that's one of the most significant aspects of her whole thing, is like her ability to be an influencer online. And I'm not denigrating that, but I'm saying is, like, it's not just people on the internet who are mad about voting for Joe Biden. It's people who are not online, but just can't reward someone who's supporting a genocide.
Right.
And I think if you're going to make the case for Biden, you have to at least acknowledge that.
Acknowledge that. Or you could also pressure Biden to stop the genocide.
There you go.
I mean this idea that I love the vote shamers who are like speaking to this amorphous, countless anonymous crowd of people who are saying that they won't vote for him, trying to guilt them into voting for him, pressure them to vote for them. You know, you could spend all that time trying to pressure Biden to stop the genocide.
Absolutely.
If you really cared and you really saw Trump as an existential threat, that's what you'd be doing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, there are people inside the Democratic Party who are standing up to Biden. And now it's pretty common when he speaks, he gets heckled by people urging him to demand a ceasefire and use the huge leverage that the U.S. has over Israel, which he refuses to do. And this happened recently at a speech that Biden gave in Virginia, in support of abortion rights, where he was interrupted multiple times by people calling him out. And we're going to watch the video, but first, he got an interesting show of support, not from fellow Democrats, but from Republicans who support his backing of the Israeli genocide. So look at how this Republican Party account characterized the protests against Biden. So this is RNC research, and they say pro-Hamas members of the Democrat Party repeatedly interrupt Biden's campaign event in Virginia, Genocide Joe. And let's watch. So the reason I picked this for Republican Suck is because basically, rather than have an opposition party to the president who's against genocide, the Republicans are using this as an excuse to attack those who dare oppose the genocide. So they're standing with their Democratic president, Genocide Joe. They support his policy in Gaza. They support the mass murder of Palestinian civilians. And they attack a few brave people in an audience who are willing to stand up to Joe Biden. So it just shows it's a uniparty in action. You know, sure, they have their differences with Joe Biden on some issues, but when it comes to supporting this genocide, they're firmly in lockstep with him. So Republicans suck.
Republicans suck. Well, I got to hand it to Joe Biden because he's such a Renaissance man that not only does he give a green light to genocide, but check out this clip of him responding to the hecklers, because some people are on the balcony.
Look, please don't jump.
Ba-dum-bum. So weird.
Is he joking or does he actually think the person's going to jump? Is he making a joke?
I don't know. I think it was viewed as a joke, but maybe he's being sincere. You never know with Biden.
Because he can't fathom maybe the idea of somebody protesting his support for mass murder. So they must be suicidal and crazy. Right, I don't know. Exactly, I mean, maybe he's making a dark joke.
Maybe. Unclear.
It's a weird joke to make.
Yeah. Or maybe he's speaking to his defenders. And he assumes they not only take a bullet for him, but jump off of a balcony for him. Unclear.
We may find another hint as to what his motives are in this other thing he said in his speech.
Oh, let's
this
see.
Might shed some light on it.
Don't mess with the women of America unless you want to get the benefit.
What?
Don't mess with the women of America. It's like,
what's he saying? Don't mess
don't
with the women of
America. Don't mess with the women of America unless you want to get the benefit.
Unless you want to get a benefit?
Yeah, unless you want to get a benefit.
So maybe he's actually doing slam poetry, spoken word poetry.
Maybe.
Because I really don't understand that. And by the way, it's worth noting he's bringing up abortion, you know, one of the things that he's running on, although his party, of course, didn't codify Roe v. Wade when they could have under his president, for whom he was vice president. But it's worth noting, we covered this on Monday, that as a woman during a panel discussion with Margaret Brennan on Face the Nation pointed out, this young woman was saying that she was not going to vote for Biden because she's very pro-choice, or this young woman was saying she wasn't going to vote for Biden because although she really cares about reproductive rights, and obviously Trump is terrible on that issue, she can't vote for someone who is forcing Palestinian women, speaking of reproductive rights, to have C-sections without anesthesia, forcing Palestinian women to not have neonatal care because there's barely any hospitals to deliver at. So women are delivering in very dangerous conditions without doctors, without hospitals, and getting C-sections without anesthesia, which is an absolute, I mean, it's unbelievable to think about
using,
that.
Using tent scraps for their periods.
For menstruation, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Unbelievable. So if you care about women's rights, newsflash, if you care about women's rights, you should care when they're being massacred or forced to have C-sections without anesthesia or forced to use tent scraps as pads. All of that falls under the rubric of women's rights, Joe.
You know, you mentioned earlier Joe Biden maybe doing slam poetry. I wonder if a president can appoint themselves to be the poet laureate of the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Wouldn't that be cool if Biden gave himself that honor?
Yeah. You know,
he's been a senator, a vice president, a president. Let's make Joe Biden poet laureate as well. Why not?
Yeah, why not? Next state, if he's inaugurated, he could do that. Yeah.
Okay. What do we have for Isn't That Weird?
For Isn't That Weird, we have a story about a Japan ANA plane turning around mid-flight after American passenger bites attendant. It's a bit of a mystery what happened, though. So according to a spokesperson for the airline, a 55-year-old heavily drunk man bit into the arm of a crew member, leaving her mildly injured. He had to be restrained by crew members before being arrested after landing back in Tokyo. But the man claims that he didn't bite the flight attendant and that he claimed not to remember what happened because he had consumed a sleeping pill. Now, I feel like if you're going to say, I don't remember what happened because I took a sleeping pill, you can't say you didn't bite. You could have done the biting and not remember it.
Sure.
And if it was Ambien, there's a lot of evidence of people sleepwalking, sleep eating. So I think he should have just gone with the Ambien offense. Like if people bite down on food, why not bite down on people? Yeah.
You know, I'm sorry to be a wet blanket, everybody, for those of you who like drinking on planes, but I'm an abolitionist when it comes to alcohol on flights. I don't get it. Like, you know, I enjoy a nice drink as much as anybody else, but I don't think we need to drink on planes. I mean, look at the history. There's such a record of bad behavior because of alcohol on flights. And it's like you're at, you know, 30,000 feet. You can't, you know, it's like you can't really do much on a plane. You also need to be aware and something could go wrong. So I think we should maybe think about giving up alcohol on all these planes. I'm sorry to be a drip. You know, I realize the people out there who like a nice drink in the sky, but I don't see the payoff. And there's been so many bad things that happen when people drink on planes.
I like that. If you ever run for office, maybe that could be your plank.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'd have to hide all my other political views. So this could be like my single issue thing.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. And I bet there's single issue voters out there who've had terrible experiences with drunk assholes on flights. And maybe you'd lock it in. Maybe Biden could run on that.
Fair enough. Yeah, there you go. That's free advice for Biden.
But then Trump would probably run on like assassinating people who drink on flights.
That's true. He would.
Or executing them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do we got for Isn't That Terrible?
The Burlington City Council recently held a meeting about the Gaza genocide. And someone who supports the Gaza genocide made a pretty funny error.
And I would like to use the rest of my time to say how appalled I am that people are bringing up the Holocaust. Do not use other genocides to describe this one. I have been...
What is that?
Well, she does not want you to use other genocides to describe this genocide. And when she realized that she had said that out loud, she rightfully got very embarrassed.
What was she planning to say?
I don't know. I mean, but that's what she said. She blurted out that this was a genocide and she doesn't like people talking about other genocides.
Right. It was a Freudian slip, perhaps.
Yeah. It was a huge Freudian slip.
Yeah.
And, you know, look, it's impossible to laugh in this horrible moment of a genocide, but.
Well, apparently not, because we just did.
We just did it at this one because.
But she's the butt of the joke, obviously.
She certainly is.
Yeah. I mean, that was amazing. That she looks like almost like a tampon that she put in front of her face.
Or her cue card.
Yeah,
but she wasn't reading off of properly, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's the message.
Ripped up tampon. Yeah.
That's the message out there, everybody. Don't use other genocides to describe this one.
I would say don't use other genocides to justify another genocide.
Hey.
Which is what a lot of people are doing.
Amen.
Implicitly or explicitly.
They certainly are. Yeah. They certainly are.
So as we said, we have two interviews on this show. We're going to be speaking with Israeli peace activist Maoz Inon, whose parents were killed on October 7th. But before that, we're going to be speaking with Asa Winstanley.
Yes, Asa Winstanley is a journalist with the Electronic Intifada, an author of the best-selling book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism, How the Israel Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn. And we are going to speak to Asa primarily about the reporting he's done about what we know and don't know about October 7th and more evidence that Israeli forces killed their own people on October 7th. And Asa has been doing stellar investigative work on this, which we'll speak to him about, along with other claims that have been made by the Israeli military about October 7th that have turned out to be false.
Asa also lived in the West Bank for 2 years, by the way. And I just want to give a little blurb for his book, because both Aaron and I, full disclosure, blurbed his book. This is what I said about his book, Weaponizing Anti-Semitism. This informative page turner is full of intrigue, a great source for anyone who wants to understand how anti-Semitism is cynically weaponized by people who don't actually care about combating anti-Semitism. And also make sure that you do subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com because our extended interview with Asa, our paywalled interview, is extremely interesting. And it's about the way he's been smeared by corporate media. He and other journalists who have uncovered the reality about October 7th have been smeared by incredibly embarrassingly bad corporate media like the Washington Post and the New York Times.
All right, let's go to Asa Winstanley. Asa Winstanley, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
You have been doing a lot of work on October 7th and specifically what we know and don't know about Israel firing on its own people. There have been a series of revelations that have come out in Israel that are not very well known inside the United States, especially because the media doesn't really cover it. What to you are some of the most significant revelations that have come out so far?
Israel, I mean, the latest one is simply that the Israeli high command, the Israeli military's supreme command on October 7th, reactivated a standing order in Israeli military circles known as the Hannibal Directive, which allows Israeli forces to fire on their own people. And this is a long-standing directive, Hannibal Directive, which was established in 1986. But this is the first, October 7th is the first known occasion that it's happened that it seems to have targeted civilians, Israeli civilians, rather than soldiers. And that, I mean, if that sounds crazy, I mean, it kind of is in a way, but the logic of it, such as it is that they want to stop the Palestinian or Lebanese fighters from taking Israelis captive, because those Israelis can then be used as leverage in prisoner swap deals, which end up releasing Palestinians from Israeli Palestinians or Lebanese or whoever it is from Israeli prisons. And this is what happened in the case of the Gilad Shalit exchange. If you remember, Gilad Shalit, an Israeli soldier, was captured by Palestinian fighters in Gaza in 2009. And in the end, I mean, he was held for years in Gaza, treated quite well by all accounts. And in the end, he was released in a prisoner swap, which cost the Israelis 1,000 Palestinian prisoners who were released, including, I believe it was in that release, Yahya Sinwar, who is the leader of Hamas in Gaza now. And so, you know, there's been so many revelations that have come out actually in the Israeli press about this. And it's kind of staggering. Like, it takes like for the mainstream media to avoid this. I mean, they've been studiously ignoring it. There's so much evidence of the Hannibal Directive taking place, but the latest revelations are about there's a new article in the Israeli newspaper, their weekend supplement of the Israeli newspaper Yediot Ahronot, which was released the weekend before last by two journalists, Ronan Bergman, who actually is a New York Times journalist as well, and has written several high-profile books, sympathetic books about Israeli intelligence services, including Rise and Kill First, and Yoav Zetun. And what this piece says, it confirms that the Hannibal Directive was reactivated, and they say it was actually reactivated. They're very specific. They say it was reactivated at midday on the 7th of October, and that 70 cars were destroyed, not by Palestinians, but by Israeli drones, helicopter gunships, or tank fire. So it confirms what we've been saying all along. It confirms what we've been reporting all along, the electronic intifada. You know, it's been studiously ignored by the mainstream media, but there's been, you know, as you know, Aaron, your colleague at the Grey Zone, Max Blumenthal, has also been one of the few of us covering this, along with a couple of other websites, Mondo Weiss and The Cradle. But, you know, outside of us, the mainstream media in the West has been really ignoring this fact. And it actually says we got that. It's a really long piece, and it's actually quite significant historically. And it's very sympathetic to Israel. I mean, it would be, you know, this is not a sort of an anti, he's not anti-Israeli journalist or anti-Zionist or whatever. They're not critical journalists in that way, but they do a fair job of reporting, you know. What it actually says is, it, as I said, it reveals, you know, we saw these images of these cars destroyed of, you know, and these were cars driven by Palestinian fighters with Israeli captives, for the most part, inside them. And they were being targeted by the Israelis and they were blown up. And an undetermined number of these casualties were then later included in this death toll. But, you know, maintained by the Israelis, saying that these were Israeli civilians killed by Palestinians. Well, you know, this is confirmation that that is not true, that these were so-called friendly fire incidents. And in their article, it says, quote, "It is not clear at this stage how many of the captives were killed due to the operation of this order," that is the Hannibal directive. And quote, "at least in some of these cases, everyone in the vehicle was killed." It's a really significant new piece, which has confirmed a lot of what we've been reporting about this.
And it's interesting because, as you said, this piece is not, you know, it's sympathetic to Israel, obviously. It was published in, as you pointed out, Yedioth Ahronoth, it's supplement 7 days.
Yeah.
And I'm going to quote from the opening of it, which you guys on Electronic Intifada had translated. "On the morning of October 7th, some of the most impressive tales of heroism and self-sacrifice in the history of the country were written, but so too was a long series of failures, mishaps, and chaos in the army." So again, it seems in this way, it's like, you know, kind of fair and balanced. It's not coming from an anti-Israel publication, and they're praising some of the responses, but also indicting many of the responses. And I also thought it was interesting, you pointed out that they do translate, this newspaper will translate their articles into English, but this one wasn't translated into English.
Yeah, and there may not be anything in that. It may just be because it's a long article.
Yeah.
It could just be that, but I don't know. I rather suspect that it may be, it, at least one of the reasons why it wasn't published was just because of the nature of it, that it reflects quite badly on the Israeli military.
Yeah, but even without my nefarious conspiracy theory, it's just, you know, it's significant that it has not been, because that, of course, means that it hasn't been picked up as much by the media. But also, as you are implying or stating, you know, if the media were interested in finding out what happened, I mean, Electronic Intifada had someone who's a native Hebrew speaker translate it. Other places have translated.
Yeah, we've seen sort of... it was interesting, like when this article came out, it was previewed the day before the weekend, which is, you know, the day, which is a Thursday, the weekend starts in on Friday in Israel. People were sharing screenshots of the kind of preview article of it online straight away, based on like a machine translation.
Right.
But we got, you know, those are not always accurate. So we got a... we got Dina Shunra, who's kind of is our long-term Hebrew translator. She's a professional Hebrew translator, and she was brought up in Israel, although she doesn't live there anymore. But she actually spent the whole weekend translating it, because it's a very long article, and it's incredibly significant. And people can read, we actually published the full translation just for reference at the end of the article, so people can read it in full and make up their own minds.
And Hannibal is someone, a figure who, it's called the Hannibal Directive because Hannibal is someone who, under the Roman Empire, rather than, I guess, submitting, committed suicide.
Hannibal was a general of Carthage. So Carthage was in ancient history was the great enemy, or sort of the nemesis of the Roman Empire. And he, you know, he of the elephants, Hannibal, who reputedly rode the elephants across the Alps. But the point is that in history, he is said to have, as you said, he is said to have poisoned himself rather than be captured alive by the Romans. So it cannot be a coincidence that it was named this. And there is this kind of strand. And again, this is something Max Blumenthal has written about. There's this strand in Israeli society, this kind of, I don't know, like some people have called it a death cult or this kind of suicidal, that's maybe not quite the right word for it, but a kind of suicidal impulse in a way, because the graduation, for another example, is Masada. I mean, if the myth of Masada, which, you know, I'm sure you're both famous with, but the Israeli soldiers at their graduation are taken to Masada, which is reputed to be, in mythology, is reputed to be this last stand of Jewish zealots to the Roman Empire. And so the idea is that, you know, and they say when they graduate there is Masada will never fall again. So, you know, the implication being that we'd rather commit suicide than be taken alive, kind of thing.
Which and is so, what happened at Masada, right? According to the myth.
According to, yeah. So the Hannibal director, I mean, it seems that, you know, it looks, I mean, according to this article, it seems like it happened. It was soldiers on the ground or pilots who decided to do this. They decided to just, because they'd been trained in this doctrine, the Hannibal directive. It happened in a kind of on the ground sort of grassroots way. And then soon after that, at midday, there was this specific order from what's called the Pit, which is the Israeli military's high command in an underground bunker below Tel Aviv, that all units of the Israeli military were permitted to operate the Hannibal directive, because a midday was the moment, according to this Bergman Zitoun article, midday was the time when the first videos of the Israeli captives started being released. And this is another incredible aspect of this article, because it shows how the Palestinian military assault on military targets on October the 7th, it shows how incredibly successful it was, because this high command, the Pit, so-called, they didn't really know what was going on. And it was only by looking online, really, that they could see what was happening. So they, according to this article, were relying on telegram channels in large part, partly Israeli telegram channels, but also Hamas telegram channels. And that's how they saw the videos of these Israeli captives. So they probably saw them emerge around about the same time as us. And the reason for this intelligence failure was that the Palestinian fighters had targeted the communications infrastructure. And they'd deliberately targeted the communications masts and aerials and so forth around the military bases when they broke out of Gaza. And so the high command was in the dark.
One more thing about, sorry, Hannibal, is that and Masada, I do think it's interesting that according to the Masada legend, which has been challenged by archaeologists, but according to the legend or the mythology around it, it's not just that they committed suicide rather than submit to the Romans, but that the men gathered together, decided that they would kill themselves, but also each man killed his own wife and children.
Huh.
Which is,
Are we supposed to celebrate all this?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I have to admit, I've had the misfortune of being taken on the Masada tour as a young North American Jewish person. And, you know, it was really corny, and it's supposed to be a very emotional thing. Like you hike up early in the morning and they take you there and you're supposed to feel this connection to this place. Like the sacrifice was done for us, and it's really corny and obviously a fantasy. Dangerous. As well. Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting. I hadn't thought of that part of I'd forgotten that actually. So it's interesting you bring that up, Katie, that they killed allegedly. How true these things are is questionable, yeah. But that they also killed their wives and children. And you see some of that rhetoric. You saw some of that rhetoric come out around the 7th of October. I mean, if you remember, do you remember this? This guy, Thomas Hand, I don't know if you saw the video of that. His daughter, Emily Hand, was captured by Palestinian fighters on October 7th. And there was this famous or infamous interview with her father, Thomas Hand, who's a settler from Ireland by the look of it. In this sort of tear-jerking interview with Clarissa Ward of CNN, he said when he heard his daughter was dead, wrongly as it turned out, thankfully, he heard from the Israeli military that his daughter was dead. He said yes and cheered, because if you know about what happens to you in Gaza, it's worse than death. And he was very tearful and very, you know, he sincerely seemed to believe this, right? And now, you know, thankfully it turned out that she was alive and she was later released released by the Palestinian fighters during the brief pause in fighting that took place in November. But, you know, that's kind of an example of this kind of ideology kind of seeping through. And I saw another example of that, which I wrote about in another article, where there was, I think it was in Kibbutz Be'eri, but there was another man who said that he, in an account, his name was Or Yelin, and he was the son of a local politician in, I believe, in Kibbutz Be'eri. It may have been one of those communities near Gaza, one of these Israeli settlements near the Gaza Strip. And he said that he and his wife had discussed during the assault that if by the Palestinians, that if Hamas had come to them, he and his wife both agreed that he would take a kitchen knife and stab his wife. And this is what he was saying to Israeli media. So there is this kind of, I don't know, suicidal cult really embedded in Zionism and in the Israeli state. And so, yeah, and the thing as well that's really, I mean, it should be emphasized about the Hannibal Directive is that it's not over. Like, it wasn't just something that was just happening on the 7th of October. They're still kind of doing it in Gaza, right? Because they're bombing everything, even when they know that there are Israeli captives there. Leave aside all the Palestinian, 25,000 Palestinian civilians they've massacred. They know Israelis' captives are there, and they're still shooting, bombing, and killing them. And it seems like it's starting to seem like, you know, the political leaders of Israel do not want those captives to come home alive.
Well, it's so ironic because there's so much propaganda about Muslims, Arabs, Palestinians, you know, which a lot of people use those terms interchangeably, mistakenly, that they are a death cult, that they don't value life, that they value martyrdom. And as you're pointing out, as we know, I mean, it's insane that this country that was founded allegedly to protect Jews and save Jews and protect Jewish life from extermination, it's just insane to see that they're not doing everything that they can to get the hostages out. You know, this is their shtick, that they do everything to save Jewish life. We know that they're fine killing Palestinians, but their thing is that they're supposed to care about Jewish life. And to see them, as we're discussing, actually bomb the places where these hostages are or open fire on them, which we saw them do.
Right.
As they were holding, you know, white flags.
Yeah.
And it's just such projection. And so it's like, it's kind of delusional. And you know, that I'm not saying there weren't atrocities committed on October 7th, but the idea that because this girl had been kidnapped, as his father suggested, she'd be, you know, subjected to torture is kind of contradicted by what we see when these hostages have been released. And, you know, there's that girl who was released. It wasn't just her. She had her dog with her, you know, she's able to keep her, not just herself alive, but her dog alive.
Yeah.
It's just really stunning.
Yeah. There's a lot of projection going on there. Absolutely. people have been talking about that a lot. I mean, yeah, I mean, look, being taken captive is going to be a scary experience, of course, and absolutely no doubt about it. But from the accounts that we've seen of the captives that have been released, they've been treated well from what we can see.
Certainly better than how Palestinians are treated in Israeli prisons. Hey, so let me ask you, when it comes to October 7th, somebody might hear what you're talking about, read your reporting, acknowledge that Israeli forces may have killed their own people, but they might say, all right, well, so what? It was Hamas that attacked. They killed civilians. They took civilians hostage. So yes, in the crossfire, Israel killed some of its own people. But what does that really matter if it was Hamas that attacked first? So how would you respond to that?
Well, what I would say is that it matters because the justification that is being used for this genocide that's taking place in Gaza right now is that the attacks of 7th of October were uniquely evil, as it's being put forward, that they were, you know, deliberately targeting and killing civilians, and that it wasn't a military assault. You know, there was no rational, it was just killing for the sake of killing. There was no rational goals they wanted to achieve. And so I think it matters, you know, it matters because the idea is that Palestinians are just killing Israelis, civilians, and just killing for the sake of it. And that these figures that are put out, you know, at first it was 1,400 Palestinians who have said, 1,400 Israelis that they claimed were killed by the Palestinians. And then that was later reduced to 1,200. And now it seems to be, if you read some Israeli reports, it's they say they use this term more than 1,000. And so, you know, as you look at the figures of the death toll, more and more you see that more and more of those people killed were actually not civilians. Like, there's another example in this article where it says that the Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence agency, that its director ordered anyone with weapons training, anyone with a weapon to hand, to actually take part in the fighting and to go down south. And apparently 10 Shin Bet officers were killed in that during the battles. Now that's significant because if you look at the figures, which, for example, in Haaretz, which maintains this database of the dead, the database is a bit confusing because it kind of blurs together Israeli soldiers who died invading the Gaza Strip since then in the ground assault with the Israelis who were killed on the 7th of October and in the immediate days after. So it's a little bit confusing, but some of it, the figures do include dates when they were killed. And if you search through that, if you do, because there is, you can, in that database, you can do a text search. And if you search for Shin Bet, you can see three of the dead who are described in that database as Shin Bet officers. And that's interesting because you can break down the dead. There's filters. You can apply filters of civilian, military, police, and emergency services, which is a bit ambiguous. But at least on the surface, sounds like it's civilians. Well, all the Shin Bet officers are either civilian, quote unquote, or emergency services. So, you know, that shows that some of these alleged civilians were actually armed men who were taking part in the fighting on the day. So, you know, it's I think it's significant, and facts like this do matter.
Yeah, and it's also important because Israel has been caught lying about multiple other claims from October 7th, right, in terms of putting out atrocity propaganda, talking about dozens of beheaded babies that turn out to be false. Yeah. And that makes it all the more important to get to the truth of what actually happened on October 7th. And that's not to deny that Palestinian militants executed civilians. Some of that is on tape. So that happened. But the question is, why wasn't Israel content just with showing what is demonstrably true? Why did it have to go ahead and put out all these false atrocity claims about dozens of beheaded babies? And accordingly, is it then also possibly exaggerating the number of civilians that were killed by Palestinians to cover up for the fact that some were killed by Israeli forces? And, you know, on this note, about fake claims by Israel. Let's turn to another fact check from an Israeli media outlet. This is Israeli Channel 13, who just put out a video debunking claims put up by the Israeli military about some of the alleged atrocities committed by Hamas. Watch the following footage of the Kafir Brigade commander from Channel 14. We arrived in Kibbutz Be'eri, and there I encounter two main images of the battle, apropos of the enemy's brutality. One is a nursery school with innocent children. They were butchered, killed. You see the children inside the house. Eight babies died. And another image that caught my attention is when I saw Jenya, may she rest in peace, an elderly woman from Kibbutz Be'eri, and I see the number engraved on her arm. And you say she went through the Holocaust in Auschwitz and in the end died in Kibbutz Be'eri. That's not something that you can't even understand it. And now we go back to the Israeli journalist who says, well, no eight babies were killed in Be'eri. According to the kibbutz spokesperson, and there's no woman named Jenya in Be'eri. Watch some more footage from not long ago of a soldier speaking. And now an Israeli soldier says, there were also children here, babies, who were hanged on a laundry line, really, in one line. It was very hard to see. When I saw it, it shocked me. You don't really understand what you're seeing in front of your eyes. Is it a picture or is it really reality? It's very, very hard to understand. And now back to the Israeli journalist who says, Boskila is talking about a supposed event in Kfar Aza. But in Kfar Aza, they made it clear long ago that this event simply didn't happen. By the way, he said the things. He was told that it didn't happen in a tour of foreign news journalists who came there. And pay attention to what the police spokesman said to the foreign media not long ago. Pay attention. And the spokesperson says, a pregnant woman cut open. The things that are happening are so sick. This is not a Netflix show. It's not a cable news show. None of that. No, this is real life. And back to the Israeli journalist. No, this also didn't happen. So many terrible, cruel things happened. Some of the most cruel things that can be done to a human being on 7th of October. Why were things that didn't happen said? So there we go. That's an example of you have three Israeli officials, soldiers, on camera caught lying through their teeth. And that kind of debunking you will not see in US media, you won't see it in UK media, you do see it in Israel.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was a great discussion.
It was very good. And if you want the full interview with Aso and Stanley, go to usefulidiotspodcast.com, where we get into more Israeli military fabrications, and we talk about an article in the Washington Post that smeared both ASA, the Electronic Intifada, and the Gray Zone, and specifically an article there by Max Blumenthal.
And now we turn to our interview with Maoz Ynon, who is an Israeli peace activist whose parents were tragically killed on October 7th. Maoz Ynon, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
Also, obviously, want to offer our condolences to you for your loss. Can you tell people, to the extent you're comfortable, obviously, about what happened to your family on October 7th?
Yes, of course. First, I will start that I was born 48 years ago in Kibbutz Niram. It's about a kilometer and a half off the Gaza border. My both grandparents were Zionist pioneers immigrating to Palestine under the British mandate at the 1930-something, founding two kibbutzim in the Negev. And when my parents got married, they moved to live at my father's house, at my father's home and kibbutz in Niram, where they raised my three sisters, my young brother and myself. And at the age of 14, we moved to Netiv Asara. It's another small Israeli community, about 1,000 people, just touching the border, the Gaza border from the north side. On And on October the 7th, I woke up in my house in Binyamina, and I watched the WhatsApp still from bed, my WhatsApp messages, and I saw that my dad wrote in the family group that there are sirens, alarm, missiles, shooting, a lot of noise, and they left the house, and they are inside the safe room. As crazy as it might sound, it's normal. It's happening every few months or once a year at least. So I said, okay, it's another, we have another, something is coming. But I went usually to make coffee for my wife and for myself. And while making the coffee, I saw in the news that there is a Hamas invasion to the neighboring Israeli communities to the border. And this is something I never remembered that happened before. And it, of course, it never happened. So I said, wow, I better call the dad. So at 7:40, I called him and he said exactly what he wrote. They are in the safe room, a lot of noise, shooting, alarms, sirens, and that he and mom are in the safe room. I could hear my mom in the background. So I just told him, tell mom I love her, I love you, and I'll talk to you soon. And keep watching on the news and seeing the wall has been fallen and the Hamas trucks in Sderot, which is like the nearest town. I know it so well. I said, wow. Like I was really shocked. And I said, I should call dad again. And it was 7:45. And this time there was no answer. So I called my three sisters who live in Israel and my brother who lives in London. And we tried to call them and their neighbors. There was no answer from no one. We hoped or wished it was electricity failure or cellular reception that is down. But we said it's better we group together with the 8 grown grandchildren from the age of 12 to 19. So we grouped at my sister's house at around 11 Saturday morning, October the 7th, trying to reach them. And when we were able to reach their neighbors, and then they were WhatsApping us from their closets, or like safe rooms, cannot talk, really short messages. We just told them on WhatsApp that we wanted to know what's happening. We don't need a delegation or official something. We just want to know what's going on. And 5 in the afternoon, we were able to reach the security office of Netiva Asara. And he told us that my parents' house is burned to ashes with 2 bodies inside.
Can you tell us a bit about your parents?
Yes. First, they were loving and supporting parents for my sister, my brother, and myself. My father was 78, my mom 76. They were in the prime of their life. They were all over the place. My father was an agronomist consultant, working from north to south. He was probably number one expert in Israel for wheat, sunflower, corn, chickpeas, watermelon, working full time. He was very active, walking on the beach at least 5 kilometers a day, practicing Pilates daily. And my mom, she was an artist. And since I remember, she was doing art. And even in the early 80s, she was doing art from garbage, what now is so trendy. Mm. So I remember like every summer, she would ask us to keep all the ice cream stick. So we would keep all the ice cream stick. And at the end of the summer, we sat around the table and she gave us colors so we can paint those Arctic sticks. And then she glued them together and framed it, and it was on the wall of the house till October the 7th. And in the recent year, she was a mandala painter and also teacher. She had a group of students from children, youth, adult, and elderly that would come every week for a mandala lesson, and she refused to take money from her students. And her student argued with her that she must, and they reach an agreement that each one will pay as much as he can. And she was also swimming every day, practicing yoga, And both of them were very loving and existing in their grandchild, with their grandchildren. Again, the three young one lives in London and the adults live in Israel. So they are very loving and very active.
And what do you have to say about the way Israel has responded to October 7th?
Oh, I have a lot. I have a lot to say. So I'll start that already on October the 7th in the evening, we've decided we're going to start the Shiva without a rabbi or official announcement that they are dead. So it was the first Shiva of the war. And each day of the Shiva...
And can you just explain for people who don't know what, Americans will say, a Shiva is?
Shiva is the Jewish way of mourning. It's like a wake ceremony that is going day after day for 7 days. And Shiva is seven in Hebrew. So when all your friends, your parents, my parents' friend, many phone calls, messages, thousands of people came to pay their condolences, hug and cry with us. So every morning we started with just my brother and sisters sitting together, and during the evening with the grandchild. And I think it was the second or the third day that we say that from our personal strategy, we want to make a universal message. And our message is, you shall not revenge. We are not calling, asking for revenge the otherwise. You shall not revenge. So this was the first thing we said already during the Shiva, and definitely we are saying it now. And after we end the Shiva, it was Friday afternoon, and after a week of crying, I know how to cry, and I can make other and assist other to cry. It's very important to cry. So suddenly my mind become very clear and sharp, and I told myself, Maoz, you are on a mission. You're on a mission, and your mission is to bring the hostages back, to stop the war, to do what you can so this extreme right radical government will resign. And the most important mission is to create hope, to convince yourself, your family, and all the others that the future is going to be a better future. And going back to your question, is what the Israeli government is doing now is exactly the opposite. They are doing everything that they can in their power to make our future miserable for Israelis and Palestinians, that we live on our sword forever, and that this cycle of blood, of death, of revenge, of fear that is going on for a century now will continue. They are doing exactly the opposite than what is needed to bring security to the people of Israel, and also equality and justice to the people in Palestine.
And what about their, how do you see their role in preventing or not preventing October 7th?
I see the government of Israel accountable for October the 7th, for betraying my parents, but 18 more members of my parents' community and 100 and more victims from the communities next the borders, because the state of Israel was founded and established under the rule or the message, it shall never happen again. It shall never happen again that there will be pogroms and Jewish victims in a massive numbers. This is why Israel, the state of Israel, was established. And they failed in their promise. The state of Israel failed in fulfilling its most its number one promise. And of course Hamas is also to blame, but Hamas is a terrorist fundamental extreme organization, and his aim and his motivation and way of acting is to kill innocent people. So Hamas was doing what is expected from a terrorist organization. And the state of Israel and the Israeli government failed in doing what they were expected. But from that, I want the lesson I learned during the last 3 months. And this one, I learned many lessons from peace activists that are working on the ground for many years. And one of the most amazing and admirable peace activists is Hamza Awoude. He's from Ramallah, Palestinian from Ramallah. And what I learned from Hamza was his words: I'm willing to forgive about the past. I'm willing to forgive about the present, but I won't forget myself and no one else if we won't build a better future. So I'm willing to forgive. I'm willing to forgive everyone for everything, for the past and for the present. But I won't forget no one if we won't build a better future.
When you call Hamas a terrorist organization, I mean, do you think October 7th would have happened if Palestinians weren't occupied and besieged by Israel?
Again, I cannot tell how the past will be in under different circumstances. And also, for me, I don't care about the past anymore. I really don't care. I don't care who started it. I don't care how many numbers of victims. I'm not counting victims. I'm not counting innocent people. All innocent people who died are human beings that wasn't supposed, and I'm crying for the death. I start crying for them at the beginning. I cried so much for all the innocent lives that will be lost during this war. So who started it? Who's to blame? I'm not there. I'm not in this game or blaming game. We are all to blame because we haven't done enough. But I'm looking into the future. I'm just looking into the future. And in the recent years, I've been working a lot with narratives, Palestinian and Israeli narratives. I was doing tours in Nazareth, which is the largest Palestinian city within Israel. Nazareth is in the Galilee. All the population in Nazareth are Palestinian with Israeli ID. One out of five citizens in Israel, not the West Bank, not in Gaza, one out of five is from the Palestinian minority. These are huge numbers. It's a big minority. So I was doing tours in Nazareth, and I was emphasizing the importance of knowing the other side narrative. It's a completely different narrative. The Palestinian and the Israelis, it's a completely different narrative. So just by knowing the other side narrative, we don't need to agree. And definitely there is no point in arguing, because if we'll argue, another 100 years of this bloody cycle will continue. But if we know the other side narrative, we can step forward. So I want to step forward.
And just before focusing on moving forward, I know that I'd read something where you said your parents were concerned about what was happening. I guess two questions. Like, very recently, right, they were concerned. They saw things happening and heard gunshots. Was that the day of, or were they saying stuff before, in the days before?
So first, my parents and also their community, they weren't living in fear. They weren't living in fear. They trusted the IDF, the Israeli security system, the intelligence, and the government for protecting them. The wall that was surrounding their village was the highest wall probably human being ever built, and the deepest wall human ever built, and with the most highly sophisticated and invested and pricey security system. So they weren't living in fear, but there were many signs that something is going to happen, and many from the communities try to alarm and tell about those signs, but everyone ignored them. So there are, I think it was Monday or Tuesday before October the 7th, that Hamas was doing a training day that they all said it never happened before. So the flying machinery that they used to go over the fence, they were doing it, but
the paragliders,
the engine paraglides, they were training with them. on the like 10 meters from the Moshav fence and wall, but on the Palestinian, on the Gaza side. But they are using them and flying with them and training. And they were training with the heavy firing, but to the sea, not to the west, not to the east. And on Saturday, they were just doing the real thing, which they practiced for so long. So there are a lot of warning, but everyone ignored.
And people on, did your parents and their friends tell authorities, tell police about it? Yes. Or
they told everyone. And everyone said, it's okay, Hamas is training. That was the official answer. There were also electricity breakdown in the last 6 months, that for a few hours, there was no electricity in the community. So they called the Israeli electricity company, they called the military, they called the police, and everyone said, it's not us. No one knew why and what is happening. And then after a few hours, the electricity came back. So of course, it fell down again on October the 7th morning.
And I'm sorry, this is very sensitive, but have the authorities given you any indication of how your parents were killed? And what I'm wondering here is, there are testimonies now from survivors of October 7th who've spoken about Israeli tanks firing at homes, for example, at Kibbutz Beri. There was another investigation recently from Yediot Aharonot, the Israeli newspaper, about how Israeli forces fired on vehicles that contained hostages from October 7th. So do you have any clarity on what happened to your parents, how they died?
So first, I don't read newspaper personally, but I do know about the cases you are talking about. And I don't trust the Israeli government or military to really investigate. I personally, as a citizen of Israel, someone who lived here and was born here, I don't believe the outcome of those investigations, if they will ever make any investigation. But I'll tell you another thing that I was asked much more direct question from a Palestinian friend, a very close friend that knew my parents very well. And she asked me, Maoz, maybe, I just want to raise this question. Maybe what burned your parents' house with your parents inside wasn't a Hamas rocket. Maybe it was a crossfire. So first, for me, as an Israeli who just lost his parents, it was very difficult to hear this question. Very difficult. And like she's saying me, it didn't, basically she said it didn't happen. But then I told her, you know what? Maybe you are right. Maybe it wasn't the Hamas. Maybe it was a crossfire. But what does it matter? My parents died because of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And my mission in life, I decided to commit my life for making peace. What does it matter who killed them? They were killed because of the conflict. And I'm going to solve, and I'm going to make peace between the river to the sea. Do you want to join me in my efforts of making peace? Or do we want to question or argue or about who started it and who's to blame? So, of course, she said, yes, I want to join you in your efforts. So this is what I'm saying. We didn't need to answer a question with an argument. Let's answer a question with something productive, something that will take us forward. And I will have my own narrative that it was the Hamas. If I would think it was the Israeli government, I don't know how I could live. I'm very honest and open with you. I don't know how I could live if I would know that it was a crossfire. So my narrative is the Hamas. And for her narrative might be different. And again, and it's okay, I'm not going to argue with her. But I'm going to build a shared future with my Palestinian friend. And this is where I put all my efforts.
I know that you've been taking part in protests since October 7th. What have those been like? How have you been treated by police? And what have you been calling for?
So at the beginning, I was still very mad and there was a lot of anger inside of me. Till I learned the lesson from Hamza Awad that I need to forgive. So we started a protest opposite of the Knesset, the Parliament House of Israel, with another new liberal families from October the 7th. And we started a protest tent, and some of the families are there 24/7 with a very, very direct call and message that the government is accountable and the government must go.
And how have you been treated at the protests?
Again, the police is playing this as a bereaved family. The police are much more caution than on the normal people, not privileged as us. But the government and the police are against and shutting down or canceling protests that are calling for ceasefire, that are calling for empathy with the people in Gaza. So it's we are definitely feel that the calls and for a ceasefire and for stopping the war are being silenced brutally or with like letters from the police that we cannot hold the protest.
What did your parents think of the treatment of Israel's treatment of Palestinians? Were they concerned that something like this would happen?
I don't. Again, we were like living it. The wall and was so high, physically, but also spiritually, that we didn't saw it. It was just there, but we didn't. It wasn't part of the our family dinners, which we had once a week or twice, like a few times a month when we all gathered. It wasn't the topic. It wasn't what we spoke about, the situation of Palestine. And my parents did went to protest against the government, and they were politically active. But, and again, and of course, I was much, much more active. But on family meetings, it wasn't like, it wasn't a topic. It wasn't on the table, literally.
It seems like most Israelis are supportive of Israel's response to October 7th. People who haven't even, who haven't experienced what you experienced. You experienced loss. Your parents were killed. And yet you're able to say, not in my name, not in our names. Don't, you know, we're not calling for revenge. Why do you think it is that you're able to see this and so many other people aren't?
It's the easiest way for a government or a regime to control the mass, the public opinion, is by fear, by finding an enemy, by dehumanizing this enemy. And Hamas was doing all in its power to help the Israeli government to dehumanize him and the people of Gaza. It's for me, it's devastating. It's a tragedy that like, I see it happening in front of my eyes, and I'm trying to stop it, but I don't have the power. So this is why I am thankful to you for amplifying my voice. And I'm not alone. There are many, many Israelis that are calling for a diplomatic solution, that are calling to stop the war, that understanding that if we'll kill 20,000, 30,000, 40, I ask, how many Palestinians do you want to revenge? It won't bring security. It won't bring peace. It just create a call for revenge from the other side. So there are many Israelis that see it as I see it. But we've been silenced. We've been silenced by the Israeli media, by the Israeli press, and also by international community. By international community. They are not coming when ambassadors, head of the Biden administration are coming to visit Israel, and they are coming on a daily basis. They are meeting, and I, of course, it's very good at meeting the family of the hostages, but they are not meeting the peace activists.
What do you think of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and do you agree with the widespread criticism that basically he has a political incentive to keep this assault on Gaza going for as long as possible because of the questions he faces about October 7th and also the corruption charges that he faces and wants to avoid.
So again, I want to be modest, but I think I'm the first one who said that, and it was Thomas Friedman wrote it on the New York Times week after I said it. I don't think he heard me, but I have it record that it's a political war. It's within the Israeli prime minister agenda that will the war will continue forever because it allows him to unite the mass people of Israel around this cause, around this hate and fear. And it's serving him. And at the same time, it serves the Hamas because Hamas popularity is also rising as much as the war is continuing, as much as the suffering and the victims number in Gaza is rising. So the war is serving both the extremists, and we were hijacked by our government and by Hamas that are bringing this region into a catastrophe. And if we won't stop, it might get much worse. And this is what really frightened me. When I was saying about much worse, it might be the end of Israel as we know it. And I don't want, like no one could imagine October the 7th. No one can imagine what will happen if this cycle will continue. And I also say before, and I'll say it now, even though, again, I'm now, it's not what I'm dealing with now. I don't mind talking about it, but it's not where I am at the moment, that Netanyahu is the worst Jewish leader in the Jewish history. In the Jewish history, is the worst leader ever since the beginning of Judaism, about 3,000 years ago to nowadays. He will be considered as much as humanity will continue, the humankind will survive and be on planet Earth, who will be considered the worst Jewish leader ever. But we're all going to suffer from it.
And why do you say that he's the worst Jewish leader ever?
Because I think he put the third Jewish existence in Israel to a risk that might bring to its end.
And can you just explain to people who don't know about this how this war is helping him politically?
Yeah, because he, like the opposition, some opposition parties join his coalition of war. So he's got like, if before he had a majority of 64 against 56, now I think he have like 80 votes against 40. So he have a huge coalition of war. And they, the parties in the coalition says that they will continue supporting Netanyahu as long as the war continuing. So of course he wants the war to continue. And of course he don't care and he don't mind about the hostages. They are political hostages in the hands of Netanyahu. He don't want an agreement to bring them back during an agreement or a deal. He don't mind, he don't care about them. He just don't care.
What do you think Israel should be doing right now? You've been talking about how you want to look forward. Some questions about that. What do you think Israel should be doing right now? If they cared about the hostages, what would they be doing?
If I was the prime minister, first I will call for an international summit, peace summit, and stating that I want to end the conflict and the blood and the hate between Israelis and Palestinians. And I'm willing to do everything to bring this war to an end. So I will completely stop the war. And I'll ask for international summit that Israel will lead and call for with all Arab leaders, with the US, with the Europe nation, maybe others. Everyone wants to solve this conflict. And I will start negotiating and threatening the Palestinian authorities, not the Hamas. It was for 20 years, he's been financing the Hamas. Hamas becomes so strong, not from the air, because Netanyahu allowed them to get so strong. and I will strengthen the Palestinian authorities. And I will call the people of Palestine and the leaders and the Arab world that Israel has decided that it wants to make peace with them and that they are willing to work very hard and with pure intention to bring it into a two-state solution, confederation, whatever will be achieved on an equal level in on a negotiation table and not by war. In the war fields. And I will call the people of Israel at the same time and tell them, and I would use the words, the former prime minister from the Likud, Menachem Begin, who was the first ever prime minister from the Likud party, the same party as Netanyahu. And when Menachem Begin welcomed President Sadat of Egypt back in 1979, and Egypt, it's also important to understand, for Israelis and for your listeners, Egypt was 100,000 times stronger than the Hamas. She had a Russian military equipment sent by airplanes and ships, including aircraft, including artillery, including anti-aircraft missiles. They were very strong. After only 6 years after the most devastated war Israel had so far in 73, only 6 years after, Menachem Begin is welcoming President Sadat of Egypt in Jerusalem. And what Menachem Begin is saying, we can prevent the war, but we cannot prevent peace. So if I was the prime minister now, I would say, I want to follow the world, the legacy, the heritage of former prime minister from the Likud, from the right. Legacy and to go on the path he established back in 79. And it's time now to go back to this path and not to the path of war and hate.
What do you think a two-state solution would look like? And do you think a one-state solution could ever be possible with equal rights?
So I would say my personal answer is that I don't care. I don't care. It can be one state, it can be 10 states, as long as we live peacefully among each other and as long as we share values. It's like the EU. What does it matter if in the EU there will be 20 or 30 or 40 states? It doesn't matter. And again, the EU was founded on the ashes of Europe. It didn't come from somewhere, from the outer space. It was founded on the ashes of Europe. And between France and Germany, there were millions of victims, maybe more, during the two world wars. And now they are partners, they are allies, they are the leaders of the EU. So it's been happened in the past, not that long ago, 8 years maybe. So it can be happened here in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine, in the Israel and the Arab world. But we need to imagine it. We need to use our political imagination. It's something we stop using definitely here between the river and the sea. We must use our political imagination to imagine a better future based on equality, on justice, of reconciliation, and to start build a plan, strategy plan together. Palestinian Israelis make the plan and execute it.
And when you say this could be the end of Israel, how do you see that even happening? What does that mean?
Like there was the first temple back, I don't know, like 2,500 years ago. There was the second temple till 70 after BC. And countries, nation are stopping to exist. If you look on the world global map, yeah, and you go 100 years ago and you see how much the borders and states and nation coming up, going, rising and falling. And it can be the fall of Israel. There would be no Israel.
But how would that happen? Like what would happen?
Like if you would ask me on October the 6th.
Right.
So the Hamas will attack. You would ask me, how would it happen? I don't know.
Okay.
I cannot forecast it.
Right.
But like things can be much, much better. And this is, we need to make it be better. Things can also go really, really worse. So it's up to us to decide which way we want to go and to take it.
Thank you so much for your time. You've been so generous with your time. Any final words that you want to share about how, like, what concretely needs to happen moving forward?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I would love to share it. I'm an entrepreneur. I've been initiating more than 20 enterprises, tourism, social, political. And there is a methods that run within all my initiatives. Big dream, values, partners, strategy plan, execution, and constant look for meaning. And I become a tourism entrepreneur, and I'm working in the same methods. I have a dream of peace. I have values that I already stated. I think we all agree on them. I'm building partnerships. And now I want to ask you, do you want to be my partners? Do you want to be my partners in reaching this peace? And this is what the question I ask in all my meetings. And I always, still so far, got yes. I'm still waiting for your answer. Yeah. Katie and Aaron, if you want to be my partners. Because we need to build partnership, alliance. And now we'll build a strategy plan. And we'll execute it. It's the same way as you're building a business or a concept or an idea. Taking an idea, making a vision into reality. And now I'm building a strategy with many partners, Palestinian Israelis, and international community. We are sitting now building the strategy, and we're going to execute it, and we're going to make peace in 4 to 6 years. And if your listeners and yourself, how can we help? How can we support? There are so many shared initiatives, Jewish and Arabs, Israeli and Palestinian. So many. Support us just by amplifying our voice. Share on social media, share it to your friends, invite me to speak to you, to your audience, if it's in universities, a classroom, or a workplace. I'm not alone. There are many of us. We are giving our hands to you and ask you to be our partners in reaching this peace. We're not going to be able to do it by ourselves.
Thanks so much, Miles. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Very grateful to Miles Inon for sharing his story. I can't imagine how difficult it must be still processing the killing of his parents. And he's out there, one of the rare voices in Israel calling for peace. And even though there are some areas where, you know, I don't agree with him when it comes to, you know, my conception of the state of Israel and other matters, I really appreciate that it's very difficult in Israeli society right now to speak out. And he's one of the few people doing it. And he's not letting his tragedy become weaponized to create even more tragedies.
Exactly. And it's noteworthy that he's someone who has lost people on October 7th. And he's not calling for increased bloodshed while you have people who didn't lose anything October 7th who are.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I hope he prevails because if Israel could stop this genocide, I mean, how many people's lives would be saved if it just stopped today? And how many people, it's just unfathomable to think about. So very grateful to him for coming on.
Yeah, very much so. Thank you so much.
All right. UsefulIdiotsPodcast.com is our website. Please go there to support the show and get bonus content. And we'll see you next time. Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at UsefulIdiotsPodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter @UsefulIdiotPod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.